to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hello, everybody. Today we hear from Dr. Carolina Gutierrez Junquera of the Universidad Autónoma de Madrid on eosinophilic esophagitis. And I shall, for reasons of tongue twisting, call eosinophilic esophagitis EOE from here on in. In her training, Dr. Gutierrez Junquera passed through the Complutense University of Madrid and its affiliated hospitals. After a fellowship in pediatric gastroenterology, nutrition, and hepatology in the San Francisco Bay Area in the United States, she went home to Spain to develop her interest in various aspects of EOE. And in that disorder in particular, she has become prominent as an organizer and an evaluator of both past and present multi-institutional studies. At present, she's investigating proton pump inhibitor, PPI, use in EOE, particularly with regard to what is the role of PPIs in treatment of children with EOE and what factors, pharmacogenetic and clinical, may predict PPI response in children with EOE. But most to the point, she's been part of issuing a new set of recommendations for the diagnosis and management of EOE just about 10 years after the most recent was issued. And what has changed in those 10 years, please?
Hello. Really, in these 10 years, many things have changed. EOE is really an evolving field with many questions that we have to answer. So probably to summarize, the main differences included in the new guidelines, I would say that first, proton pump inhibitors are no longer considered a diagnostic tool, in the sense that in 2014, it was considered that for diagnosing of EOE, you need to prove that there was not response to a PPI trial.
And this first off, we have an endoscopy. We have a kid who exhibits distress while feeding, or we have a kid who may have a little bit too many pulmonary infections. I'm not sure. But on endoscopy, you take biopsies from the esophagus, which has a characteristic appearance, and you find more than 15 eosinophil leukocytes in a high-powered field, which we histopathologists understand as one using the 40 magnification objective. Back in the day when dinosaurs trod the earth and I was still a practicing pathologist, indeed, it was necessary to diagnose EOE only after other forms of eosinophilic disorders had been excluded. And one that was particularly prominent was that of gastroesophageal reflux. And that was why PPIs and the response to PPIs after 8 to 12 weeks of treatment in terms of endoscopic findings, both macroscopically and at biopsy, were so important. Mm-hmm. But you say we were all wrong.
Yeah, not all wrong, but of course, there is a group of patients that have esophageal eosinophilia that is related to gastroesophageal reflux. But at the same time, there are children and adults who have true eosinophilic esophagitis that can respond to high-dose PPI treatment. So this was a very interesting finding, in the sense that doing that PPI trial to the patients, we discovered that some of them that had the same characteristics clinically, endoscopically, and histologically to the others responded to PPI.
This is without pH studies documented gastroesophageal reflux.
Yeah. Many of these children don't have an abnormal pH study and don't have acid esophageal reflux in the pH study, but they respond to PPI. And this was a very important change in the conception of eosinophilic esophagitis, and now in these new guidelines, PPI is considered a treatment and not a diagnostic tool.
Right. Well, I'm going to ask you to just take a small side detour into the idea of PPIs as somehow taming the eosinophil.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? What are the mechanisms by which proton pump inhibitors make eosinophils say, we're not interested?
Yeah, this is a very interesting subject. In the beginning, it was thought that probably the effect was due to the anti-secretory mechanism, and that can restore the esophageal mucosal barrier. But it has been shown that there are some anti-inflammatory mechanisms related to PPI, and one of the most important is that they have shown in vitro that they can inhibit the transcription of eotaxin 3, that is a very potent chemotactic agent for attraction of eosinophils to any tissue. So this is a very important mechanism that is done through the stopping the transcription that is delivered through the STAT6 pathway signaling.
Thank you. I find that fascinating, and it certainly was not something that I expected to that I expected to hear, that there actually has been a mechanism worked out for this. Now, there we are then with children who receive not chromalin sodium, but in some other protein pump inhibitor, and who go on to improve or who fail to improve.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do with those kids? Are they to be maintained for life on PPI inhibitors?
Yeah, this is a very important question. What we have seen in a large group of patients, pediatric patients with EoE, is that about 50 to 60% of them can respond to high-dose PPI after about 3 months of treatment. And then when you reduce the dose to half dose, they maintain the response in the long term in a very high proportion, about 70 to 85%. But we know that EoE is mostly a chronic disease, and
yes,
most patients recur when the treatment is stopped. There's only a small proportion of patients, probably about 5 to 7%, that can maintain a longer time without recurrence. We don't know exactly how long, because we don't have so many follow-up
Wait just a minute. The numbers are not working for me. 50% of patients respond to PPIs, mm-hmm, and 70% of patients, let's do quick do the numbers, that's 35% of patients overall respond and then continue to respond after PPIs are withdrawn. And you're telling me that only 5%? Have I got the numbers all wrong?
No. I mean, 50% of patients respond to the induction treatment.
Okay.
And about 70 to 85% of them maintain the response on a reduced dose.
Reduced dose rather than fully withdrawn dose.
Yes.
Okay, now it's coming clearer to me. Okay. So there are some who can be withdrawn entirely, but for the majority, PPIs are going to accompany them through life.
Yeah, exactly the same than with other treatments. I mean, with other treatments that are used in EoE, such as swallow topical steroids or elimination diet, that at least with the information and the evidence that we have now, most of them have to maintain the treatment for a long time.
Well, you've just mentioned two options for treatment, the elimination diet and swallowed topical corticosteroids. Whit, I expect that you're the world's biggest PPI fan. Is there still a place for these other treatments as a fallback after PPI in those patients for whom PPI administration has not produced the desired effect?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think PPIs are a very good first option in the sense that they are easy to use and for a treatment that has to be maintained in the long term, that's a very important issue. And at the same time, they have a pretty good safety profile, but they are not as efficacious as we would like. And so
you have to have another arrow in your quiver.
Yeah, of course. For those patients or that don't respond to PPIs or that prefer other options, for example, elimination diet and not medical therapy.
Uh-huh. Well, what's your personal preference? You can talk to us. It's okay.
I think that for most kids, PPIs are a very good option. Probably the first medical therapy I will use. But in those patients that, especially families, that really want to avoid any medication and prefer to treat the disease with elimination diet, because elimination diet is the only treatment that targets the cause of the disease, that are the food antigens. I think I would go for elimination diet, starting probably with one food, milk elimination diet. And if that does not work, then decide in a shared decision-making process with the family if we are restricting more foods or going to another treatment.
Dr. Gutierrez-Junquera, I fully believe that you can walk into a patient's room and can look at the baby from the bottom of the bassinet and can say, I don't need to see anything more. I know that this child will not, or that this child will, respond to PPIs. There must be some clinical science. Excuse me. There must be some clinical science that you rely on to say, this child is going to do well with PPIs, and there may be some pharmacogenetic signs as well. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I would like to say that we have that predictive factors so clear in the clinical practice. We are trying very hard to find clinical predictive factors and also pharmacogenetic factors that can help us to choose the best treatment for the best for each patient, and especially for PPIs, this is something that we have been involved in research. From the clinical point of view, what we have found is that the most important predictive factors are related to the findings that we have in the endoscopy. So we have found that those patients that have normal endoscopy, no endoscopic findings, have a higher probability to respond to PPI. And in the contrary, those that have fibrostenotic findings, some kind of rings in the endoscopy or even stenosis, are less likely to respond. So this group of patients with fibrostenotic findings are not very good candidates to PPI treatment.
Mm-hmm. Are there biomarkers that you can use? Something in serum or in plasma?
Yeah, we have been looking for that. Unfortunately, we have not been able to identify any biomarker in plasma or serum, but we have found some biomarkers in esophageal tissue.
Oh, come on. I'm a histopathologist. You have to tell us more.
Okay. First, in collaboration with the Centers of Pharmacogenetic in Florida with Dr. Mugi and Dr. Franciosi, we have been collaborating with them, especially with our cohort of patients that have been treated with PPIs in a rigorous way. And they have studied the STAT6 variants that were present in the esophageal.
STAT6?
STAT6 gene variants, yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm. What does STAT6 do when it's at home? What does it encode, and what effects does it have outside the esophagus?
Yeah, this, as I said before, it's a way of signaling for the transcription of eotaxin 3,
that
is a chemotactic factor for eosinophils. So it is a very important signaling pathway. And this is what is inhibited by proton pump inhibitors. And then we found that certain STAT6 variants were associated with absence of response to PPI in the short and in the long term. And this,
well, that's fascinating. It's time for a quick round of congratulations on finding something so important and something that will really make a difference to how you choose treatments for these kids. So you have a baby, you have a child who doesn't have fibrostenotic changes yet. Are you arranging for a genotyping before you start? I know that you'll embark on PPI use just to have something to show the parents. We're looking at it, we're working on it until the genome studies come back. But are you genotyping these kids uniformly?
Not yet. I mean, this is some results that really help us to understand which patients have more probability to respond. But we are working with these two researchers that I have mentioned, Dr. Mugi and Dr. Franciosi, in trying to come up with a precision model in the sense that including other biomarkers probably and other signal pathways. So this is something very promising, but it's still not helpful in clinical practice, but I'm sure that in the future we will have more results that can help us.
So that's an important route for research to take in the next few years, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are there any other changes in the entering 10 years aside from PPI? Anything that you want to mention to us?
Yeah, I would like to mention that also we have included some scores that are helping us to understand the different phenotypes of the disease. It's not only the number of eosinophils, it's much more. So we are included in the guidelines the use of validated clinical scores, such as a PIS score that is validated for children. Also endoscopic scores. There's also a validated one, the RFS score, that can help us to know which severity or progression of the disease are we seeing, and at the same time how the treatment is behaving not only clinically and histologically but also endoscopically. From the histological point of view, as you are a pathologist,
yes.
And I think this will interest you, there's also an histologic score that includes not only the number of eosinophils, that of course is important, but we need to know that it's better to refer them to an area of a square millimeter because of the difference in the diameters of different microscopes.
Right. Those objectives of 40x or understood.
But at the same time, other histological findings such as basal zone hyperplasia or fibrosis of lamina propria or many others such as microabscesses of eosinophils that have also an importance in the severity of the disease or in the response to treatment.
Wow. This has been a lovely 20 minutes for me, but we only have 20 minutes, unfortunately. And now it's time to say goodbye. But before we say goodbye, we have a Spotify playlist, an Espigan Spotify favorites playlist. And we'd like to add a song that you've chosen, something that reflects your personality and a little bit about the country from which you come and your experiences, to that playlist. What is that song, please?
Well, I have chosen a song named in Spanish, Hoy Puede Ser Un Gran Día, that translated to English means today it can be a great day.
I like that.
This is a song composed by a famous singer in Spain that is named Juan Manuel Serrat. And for me, it's very optimistic. And really, it's a good song to start every morning to think that we can take advantage of our days and don't let them pass by. And so this is why I have chosen this cheerful song for the podcast.
Speaking with you today has brightened my day, and I hope that the podcast will brighten the days of other people who have been listening and who take care of kids with eosinophilic esophagitis. Thank you so much.
Thank you to you.